Today's training was developed by the ITRC team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to serve as a moderator. I'm going to quickly cover introductory material in the next few slides and then turn the presentation over to our trainers from the ITRC team. Today's training is based on the ITRC Geophysical Classification for Munitions Response, Technical and Regulatory Guidance. This is a web-based document. We're going to introduce you to it during the training class, and we do hope that it becomes a resource that you can use after today's training. Today's class is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network. A few housekeeping items to cover. We are scheduled for 2.25 hours. We are recording today's session. Using Adobe Connect, our trainers control the slides. If you'd like to control your own slides, you're welcome to download the presentation, and that's back on that Clue In training page where we started today. We do look for your interaction during today's class with the questions and the feedback. In the lower right, we have a Q&A pod, and you are welcome to send in questions anytime throughout the training. At the question and answer breaks, we're going to ask some of those questions out loud. Also, if you're on the phone line, that's your opportunity to ask questions. But we do ask that you hold the questions you ask out loud until our question and answer breaks. At the end of the class, we look for everyone to fill out the feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide. The feedback is also your opportunity to create a certificate for attending today's class. When you fill out the feedback form, be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. Once you submit, the system's going to generate a certificate for you. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website, which is itrcweb.org. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States. Overall, ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators. It includes our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of the slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. We encourage you to use ITRC's presentations and other documents for educational purposes, both in your work and if you need to deliver training to others. Please credit ITRC, review the ITRC usage policy, and let us know about your success. Use of ITRC materials for profit is not permitted. Again, more information is available on the ITRC website. We have a wide variety of technical and regulatory guidance documents. We have our training schedule for 2018 available on the website. All of our trainers were members of the ITRC Geophysical Classification for Munitions Response team. And at the bottom of the slide, we include a link where you can read more the bios for each of the trainers today. Fred Vreeman is retired from the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. Herb Nelson is with CERTP ESTCP. Ed Walker is with the California Department of Toxic Substances Control. Ed Quarrell is NAVSEA Laboratory Quality and Accreditation Office. And Andrew Schwartz isn't available, so a special thanks to Herb Nelson for filling in. Again, more information about our trainers is available following the link at the bottom of the slide. I'll now turn today's presentation over to Fred Vreeman from the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. Fred?
Thanks, Juliana. So we're starting off today with a video. Short video demonstrates what's being cleaned up. To hear the munitions on the video, you'll need to be listening to your computer speakers if you're on the phone, so go ahead and turn those on if you can. You can start the video, Juliana, that'd be great. This video shows you how metal debris is basically getting scattered all over the range.
So we're seeing the perspective from the rocket being launched. And video is moving at different paces for everyone. So I'm now seeing it has reached the target. And then we're going to see another shot of the same thing. And this is the target. And that's it on the video.
Okay. So my next slides define the problem for you. Our soldiers need to train for combat and test their weapons. Some of those rockets and shells don't blow up, and they end up being buried in the ground out on the ranges. Still explosive and very dangerous. Slide 7 now. Years later, we need to clean those areas up. On live fire ranges, there's going to be thousands of pieces of scrap metal, like you see in the graphic on the left, and maybe just a few live pieces of ordnance that didn't go off. For years, we've used single-axis sensors. For a long time, ITRC has been developing training and guidance on using those single-axis sensors for over 10 years. You can see in the photo what we call a sea of flags with thousands of pieces of metal detected below the ground that are located with these sensors and then dug up. Next slide. Cleaning up those munitions is a big job. There's 5,200 sites all over America, and half of them are going to need some kind of geophysical investigation. DOD realized really early on, if we rely on those single-axis sensors and have to dig up every one of those thousands of pieces of metal, it'll cost us billions and billions of dollars, and we won't be done until sometime into the next century. So if you could call up those first two polls, Juliana, and let us know what the results are there.
So the poll on the left shows experience with munitions response sites in general, and we're about evenly split between some knowledge and confidence and little or no experience. And if you haven't had a chance to fill out this poll, you're welcome to start filling it out. On the right, we're more specific on experience for geophysical classification. But again, we have very similar results with about an even split between some knowledge and confidence and then also little or no experience.
Okay, that's great. We're getting more folks with some experience with geophysical classification. A lot of people, if you have munitions response in the past, you only had experience with the single-axis sensors. But the multi-axis sensors have lots of advantages. First of all, we can figure out whether the object is the size and shape of a munitions item. Decisions can then be made to dig only munitions-like items and safely leave those non-munitions items in the ground. The digging we do at a site we find is significantly reduced. We'll show you more on that later. And this allows us to cover more area, of course, at a lower cost and with less disruption to the landowner. Go to the next slide, number 10. As you listen to the presenters, you're going to hear some new terminology. We sent out a sheet that has many of the terms. It's on the link there that you might be unfamiliar with. From here on out, you might want to have that sheet in front of you. So here's our definition of geophysical classification, but the pictures really tell the story better. We can tell from the data collected by our multi-axis sensors whether an item in the ground is bomb-like, like the shell on the left, or non-hazardous frag, like the scrap of metal on the right. We classify the scrap metal on the right as not being a target of interest because the scanners can tell us with certainty that it's not a bomb, so we don't have to dig it up. Okay, next slide. Here you see more targets. We found these by investigating anomalies usually caused by metal objects encountered in their geophysical scan. Often that's a single-axis scan, but it can be a multi-axis scan as well. The new multi-axis sensors, they basically tell us whether we can classify the object as a target of interest and make dig and no-dig decisions. So TOI, that's target of interest, goes on a dig list, and non-TOI, like the frag and the horseshoes, get left in the ground. Compared to using a single-axis sensor, you can see that without this technology, we would have dug up the horseshoe and the scrap metal just like as if they were a bomb. And since 80% or more of the metal at old training sites is just scrap metal, we would have done a lot of unnecessary and very expensive digging. Okay, next slide, that's number 12. We're going to show you some real-world examples here today of how classification works. Technology development for these sensors was an intensive 10-year program by DOD, and then they were tested at many sites all across the country. Early results were promising, and we realized early on that rigorous process and quality control is critical to deploying this technology. Today, we've documented several cleanups where a successful implementation was demonstrated. Links to those demonstration projects are provided in the guidance document that we're linking you to today. Again, remember the next slide, number 13, keep that glossary of terms in front of you. I'm going to show you results from some demonstration sites, and a few of the underlying terms here are going to be talked about on the next slides. Slide 14. Here's an actual demonstration site where single-axis sensors were compared to multi-axis sensors. This geophysical mapping was done with a single-axis sensor. That technology basically, as I said before, just finds all the metal, and you need to dig it up to figure out what it is or even how deep it's buried. In this area, more than 5,000 metal objects were detected that needed to be excavated. Only 16 of those were hazardous. Most of the items detected by our sensors, of course, were non-hazardous items. Next slide. Moving to another site at Camp Clybert, the Defense Department used geophysical classification. Over 6,000 items were detected. And using the single-axis sensors, we would have dug them all up. Using the new technology, that metal mapper you see here deployed with a tractor, the software analysis told us we had to dig less than 10% of those. We dug 16% just to be sure. We blind seeded hundreds of dummy items called QA seeds to test the sensors and the process, found every one of them. The contractor also seeded items every day for quality control. Now we call those QC seeds. In the process at this site, we found three actual explosive mortars, which of course is what we were looking for. Just to be sure about our decisions, we dug up another 200 unique targets, plus another 400 or more of the targets that were classified as just clutter. This was to validate the technology, to be sure nothing was left there that was not classified correctly. All those quality assurance efforts told us that the technology had correctly selected which items needed to be dug. Okay, so here's why you want to know about the new technology. With a multi-axis sensor, you're going to do a little bit more scanning and analysis, but you're going to do a whole lot less digging on your site. And you'll probably have more confidence that you got all the unexploded ordnance. You won't be able to use this on every site you find. Ed Walker's going to talk a little bit about some of the limitations. But you will learn that anywhere you might use a single-axis sensor, the new multi-axis sensors will probably do just as well or better. Next slide, please. The new technology is going to significantly reduce costs. You're going to learn that we focus a lot more on surveys, engineering, computers, quality control, things like that. But the overall cost savings will amount to billions of dollars. And most of that cost savings, of course, is not having our EOD guys digging up hundreds of thousands of horseshoes and blown up car parts at these training ranges. Slide 17. So I was a state regulator till I retired from Alaska, and I approved cleanups of munitions on several sites. When I went to my first meeting, some of the people you're hearing next, I was skeptical of this technology. So I'm sure a lot of you are also going to have questions. Of course, my first question was, does the technology work? And that was, of course, followed by, how does it work? As a regulator, I also need to ask, is it really ready to deploy? We know this is new. What are its limitations? And how do I make sure of my decisions? For a regulator like me, leaving metal in the ground was a scary thing. So I needed to be sure whatever was not dug up was really just clutter, like these sensors say it is. Our team together tackled those questions and provided answers in the web-based guidance document and in this training. Roles for contractors, stakeholders, state and federal regulators, and Defense Department managers are outlined clearly in the document. The team studied the results. We watched the demonstrations, and this whole team unanimously believes the technology is ready to deploy. Next slide, 18. The web-based guidance is really easy to use. I encourage you to go to the website, review the guidance and the case studies, and contact one of us if you have any questions about them. The site's easy to read, and as you can see here, since it's web-based, we were able to make it easier by having these difficult or unfamiliar definitions and concepts pop up to help you with the unfamiliar terms and concepts. Key decision points for your cleanup team, that's where I put the green arrows on this slide, are covered in the guidance. So the presenters you'll hear next are all part of this ITRC team. Our goal at ITRC is to break down regulatory barriers to using new technology. To do this, we got the regulators, the Defense Department guys, consultants, some quality guys from the chemistry group, because they had the most experience in quality control, and we evaluated the technology. We're here today to tell you it's ready to use. We developed a bunch of tools, wrote some fact sheets to help you explain it, advised DOD on a certification program for its use, wrote a web-based guidance, and even put together a template project plan to help you get started and manage those sites. Today, we're going to show you the software and sensor hardware technology used to classify objects as possibly hazardous, slide 20, a TOI, or non-hazardous, a non-TOI. We're going to show you how those decisions are made and validated on each of these thousands of metal objects. You'll learn some of the limitations of the technology, and we'll go into detail about the quality controls necessary for successful implementation at your site. I've already started you on the terminology and the acronyms. Yes, we're going to do more of that. Sorry about that. The training will give you enough of an introduction so that you can discuss the technology intelligently with your coworkers, stakeholders, the budget guys, people responsible for cleaning up these sites. We'll point you to our guidance document so you can access the tools you need when you evaluate classification for your site. So my role as a state regulator on the team was to evaluate the deployment of this technology and develop a process with the experts from the Defense Department that other state regulators could have confidence in. After today, we hope that you're going to be comfortable with the use of this technology and the thought that by following this rigorous approach using multi-axis sensors, we can safely classify them as non-hazardous. So the tools, the links, and the technical information you'll learn about today are summarized in that web-based guidance document. And you're going to know where to go for the information you need to make decisions at your site. So I'm here as a state regulator basically telling you I am comfortable with the use of this technology. It works, and you can use it to figure out what needs to be dug up at your site. So now, basically, let's hear more from the experts on this technology.
Thanks, Fred. Thanks. And we'll turn it over to Herb Nelson at Startup ESTCP. Herb?
Great. Thank you, Joanna and Fred, for that introduction. So let's return to Fred's sea of flags that he talked about earlier. This is a very well-known photo in this business, and many of you have worked on sites have probably seen something that looks a lot like this near a target center, where, as Fred said, there are just thousands and thousands of hits from a one-dimensional, he called a single-axis metal detector, and in the classic ways, these would all have to be dug up. So the question is, since we know almost all of them are clutter, Fred gave you an example earlier from that site where only three things turned out to be mortars. So we know very few are UXO because most munitions explode. What can we do to determine which one is which? And that's the whole point of this technology and the whole point of what we're talking about today. So it turns out, of course, that we can. We wouldn't be giving this webinar if we weren't successful in this. And we can use a technique called electromagnetic induction, sometimes written down as EMI. And we use data from those sensors to determine which ones to dig up. So we're going to go through in this section how that works in sort of a medium level. And then after that, we'll go into some applications. You'll hear from Ed Walker and Ed Coral about how to decide whether it makes sense for your site and how to set up a site to run. Okay, so let's get started. So this is pretty much what I've said already. We're going to talk about how the sensors work. On the right-hand side is a picture of one of these sensors in the field. We're going to talk about how we use the data that we acquire from these sensors. And, of course, the decision that we want to make, which is the important decision, is are we able to safely leave this item in the ground or must we dig it up? And we'll show you how we make that decision at the end of this module. So I'm giving this module today for Dean Kieswetter, who is off on spring break. So Dean likes to start with his echolocation analogy because it's familiar to a lot of people. How do dolphins find other fish or people or anything? And here's an example on the slide, the animation I hope you're seeing. The dolphin sends out an acoustic wave by making its click and then listens to the return off the fish or off the whatever target is looking for. And from that, they can tell something about the size of the item, something about the shape, something about the distance to the target. Now, we don't use sound like the dolphins do, but the point of this is we can do something very similar to that, and we do it with magnetic fields. So in an electromagnetic induction sensor, we put a pulse of current through this transmit coil and set up a magnetic field in the nearby Earth. if there happens to be a target in the area, in this case we show a little picture of a shell, but if it's any kind of a metal target, then we induce some currents in those metal targets. First we magnetize it, and then as we turn off our transmit coil, we induce some currents in it that can be detected in a secondary coil. So this is very much like the loops of wire you see at stoplights in the street. Your car is the target. There's current running through that wire. If you put a big metal car over the top of it, you get a detection, and then it knows to turn the light green. In this case, we're seeing a detection from the buried metal object, and this is what we're going to use. These data are what we're going to use to make a decision about whether we can build it up or not. And so Dean uses the analogy that we listen to the induced field. Of course, we don't listen in this case. It's an electrical signal, but we record it on a current meter, and we can see, as he's illustrated on the right-hand side of this slide, that it falls off in time, and it falls off pretty quickly. That time on that graph is in milliseconds. So after we turn off the pulse to our transmit coil, we see something that lasts 20 or 15 or 25 milliseconds, and we record that and make some learn something from it, and I'll show you in a minute how we learn something from it. So the next step is Dean would like to think about those distances. So it turns out that a dolphin is very, very sensitive and can detect a 1-inch sphere, so 2.54 centimeter sphere, 73 meters away. So that is pretty incredible. So here's a little poll we're going to have. What distance do you think that EMI methods can detect that same 1-inch sphere? So Juliana just put something up on the screen. If everybody would give a vote here. Ooh, tons of votes coming in. Good job, people. So some people think we're as good as dolphins. We got some 10 meters is coming in air. So we're about one-third, aren't we? Pretty close. I'll give you one more minute, and then I'm going to end the poll and get on with this. Unfortunately, I got a stopwatch running here, so I can't let you guys dilly-dally all day. Okay, so let's call that it. We got most people looking at 1 meter, but we've got a significant number for less than a meter and a significant number for 10 meters. So, Joanna, I'm going to move on here and tell you that the people that did the small number are so right. Nothing happened when I clicked the move on. There we go. The people that picked the small number are so right. It's really 4/10 of a meter, so 40 centimeters is how far away we can detect a 1-inch steel sphere using these EMI instruments. So there's a little plot there showing you the difference. The reason is that the EMI response is inversely proportional to the distance of the 6th power, so it falls off really fast, which means that the sensors have to be very close to the object in order to detect them, meaning we couldn't fly them from a helicopter. You can't walk around with them over the top of your head. You really have to deploy them close to the ground. And you'll see that there's various deployment modes coming up in which we accomplish that. So there's two ways really to do this. The first, I imagine if you've been on a mission site, you've seen people doing with the sensor, you just mow the lawn, you move back forth across the lawn in lines like that and cover the site. If you have the sea of flags that Fred told you earlier, though, you could just go from flag to flag to flag with the sensor, sit on top of each one and make a measurement, and obviously be much more efficient. Those are really the same, though, because if you look carefully at the one on the left, it's just a whole series of discrete points. So you can either have cover the field with discrete points, or on the right-hand side, only go to the places where you know there's something to look at and make your measurements. So here are three examples of the kind of sensors that are used for this. On the left is a person portable thing. You can see it looks sort of like a big round disc on a stick. In the middle is the cart-mounted version. You've already seen that on the picture some time ago. And on the right is a much bigger unit that is pushed by some kind of vehicle. Now, there's an advantage mostly to using relatively large units because the amount of power that you can transmit into the ground is measured in amp meter squared. That's the moment of the coil. And so these bigger coils, given that you can only put a certain amount of current through a wire before it melts, these larger coils, of course, give you more meter squared, so you get more amp meter squared. And that helps you with depth detection. So in general, I think it's best to use the biggest one possible. You can see now in the little detail that I've added to the bottom of this slide that all of these sensors are made up with multiple coils. So we can look from lots of different angles, sometimes referred to as lots of different looks, and really characterize the three-dimensional structure of the target that we're looking at. And we'll see in about two slides how to do that. So we're going to focus a lot on this cart-mounted one in the middle. It's the most versatile. It's small enough to get into most places, but it's a lot easier to push around than the vehicle towed one on the right. So I would say, I don't know, two-thirds of the work done is done by this cart-mounted one in the middle. Okay, so let's go on to that. So there, here's the top-down drawing of this thing. The picture's on the right. You can see that there are four transmitter coils, and those little things in the middle of each transmitter coil are three-dimensional receiver coils. So we talked about we have a transmitter and a receiver. So if we put current through that transmitter coil that's marked number one in this case, you can see that if we look at receiver one, we get something in the x-axis, the y-axis, and the z-axis, so we get these characteristic signals. And so that's a lot of data. There's a lot of points in there, plus there's three axes, so you can already make something out of that. But also, coil number two hears something, detects something after you transmit with coil number one. Coil number three detects something, and receiver coil number four detects something. So when we fire antenna number one or transmitter number one, we get, in fact, 12 different received signals with a large sampling over time. So we've already built up a lot of data about what's going on in the target. But it's even better than that because we actually have four different transmitters. So you've seen already what happens when we fire transmitter number one. We fire transmitter number two. We look on all 12 received channels. We fire transmitter number three, obviously all 12, and transmitter four. So you can see we've built up quite a pattern of signals based on this. You can see at the top right, 81-millimeter mortar that looks like it's something like 40 or so centimeters below our coil. Here's the problem with this, though. I'm going to start a little animation that's going to show you this target moving around. So you can see the signal changes. If you look down at those things, the signals and the character of the signals really change as the item moves around. That's a bad thing, because this is the same target in every case. It's an 81-millimeter mortar. It's clearly something we want to dig up, so we'd like to get the same signal every time we looked at it. But the signal is very dependent on what the orientation is of the target to the sensor and how far away it is from the sensor. So we got to figure out a way to overcome that, or we're like, it's hopeless. So, in fact, there is a way to overcome that. We take the signals, as you see them again on the left, the measured sensor data, and we fit them to a mathematical model for the EMI response. And by doing that, we can separate the response into two parts: the location and orientation relative to the sensor. Those are so-called extrinsic properties. Those are good when you go to dig it up. They really have nothing to do with whether it's a munition item or not. And then the things that are called polarizabilities, you can see their intrinsic response. Andy Schwartz refers to them as EMI fingerprints, whichever you'd like to call them, and those are intrinsic to the object, and those are the way we're going to make the decision whether to dig something up or not. That's not the decision we make. The decision we make is it safe to leave it in the ground? So here's some examples of that. We go back to that same animation I had before, except this time we put the derived polarizabilities on the right. Now this is good news. As the signals are changing, the derived polarizabilities are not, which means they're something that's intrinsic to the item. And so that, in all cases, no matter where we put this 81-millimeter mortar, we get the same polarizabilities on the right. That's what we're looking for. And you can see we've got them color-coded. And since most munitions are a cylindrical shape, like the thing we've shown up here is, you can see that the red axis, the axis down the long way, gives a much bigger response than the other two axes, which are, go across the short way. So that's a smaller amount of metal in those axes. And in fact, since this is cylindrical, the other two axes are exactly the same. So here already is the biggest characteristic of a munition item: one big polarizability, two small, and equal and small. And so therefore, we've got a cylindrical looking object. So we're halfway there to making the decision already. But let's talk about some other things we can learn by doing this. You can see on this slide, Dean has made a little table that what are the properties we can get and what can we learn from the polarizabilities, and we can figure out the wall thickness, the size, the shape, and all of these kind of things are the observables about the item that's going to help us make the decision of, is it hazardous or not? So here come some examples of each of those. So number one, we've already talked about, axial symmetry makes you think it's potentially ammunition. So we've given our same example on the left, although in this case it looks like it's a 37-millimeter projectile, but it's a munition item. And you can see it has one large and two small, and equal small, so therefore that's a cylindrical item. You look at the case on the right-hand side, it's a busted-up, bent-up piece of fragment, and you can see it has three non-equal polarizabilities, so there's no symmetry there, so that is more likely to be a fragment than not. Let's look at another aspect of this. Oops, slide didn't change very quickly. We'll try it again. Oh, I see. I'm sorry, I've already told you about all that. So what happens when you do somebody else's slides? Okay, the other thing we want to think about is, what is the wall thickness? Munitions in general, not all, some munitions that are made to deliver gas are thin wall, but munitions in general are very thick wall metal. And a lot of times Fred made reference to car parts that are used as a target. Those are relatively thin wall metal. And on this slide we see that the decay rate, how slowly the decay falls, how the signal falls off, it depends on the wall thickness. And so here we see that the munition on the left decays out to about 20 or so milliseconds, takes about 20 or so milliseconds before it goes away, whereas the thin wall thing on the right is only 4 or 5 milliseconds. So much, much faster decay, and therefore much thinner wall. That's the thick wall on the left is another thing that points us toward it being a munition. And then finally, size. You can see on the left-hand side, I'm looking at a little screen, so it's really pretty impossible, but that's a munition item for me to see. And since I know what the polarizabilities ought to be, that's probably a 37-millimeter projectile. It has a magnitude of something like 10 or 15 for the biggest one, and the little small piece of frag barely gets to 1, probably doesn't even get to 1. So you can see we got about an order of magnitude difference in polarizability magnitude, and that tracks with the sizes of these things exactly. So munitions tend to be thick-walled, cylindrical things that are bigger than most frag. So we've already found many of the characteristics we're going to use to make this decision. So we used to, in the very early days of this technology, try to set up a machine learning technology and make decisions and teach a computer how to make a decision. But it turns out there's a much simpler way to do it than that. There's really a finite number of munitions around. There's a couple of hundred different kinds of munitions, and that's all. So it turns out it's really easy to make a library of what all of those 200 munitions look like. And then just every time you get a signal, just go see if it looks like anything in the library. And this is a slide that illustrates what the library is. It's a whole bunch of munition signatures collected under very controlled conditions. ESTCP, where I work, generated it through a contract with Parsons, and the DOD is maintaining it. So this is the way that we decide whether something is a munition or not, and I'll show you in a minute how we do that. So what we're doing on this is sort of bringing me back to making sure I understand it. We understand, I think, now how the measurements are made. They're very analogous to how you tell whether the car is at a stoplight. They're just fancier, and the electronics are obviously a lot more expensive and a lot better. We know how to take those signals that unfortunately have a big component of orientation and location of the target in them and extract the intrinsic properties, the polarizabilities. We think we know how we're going to make the decision. We've talked about it. We're going to match it to a library, so let's go do that. So most of, as I just said, we match the library. Most things get on the dig list. Most things are marked as munitions by basing matching to the library, and that's the first thing on this list. But there's other two things we do, too. Be part of a cluster. And in this sense, cluster means a number of different items in our field that all have the same signatures, but we don't recognize it as a munition. So that's nobody, with any sense about them would go away and leave unknown things in the field. If there's a number of items that we don't recognize, we have to go find out what one of them is. And then the final way is just to be safe. If you're big and deep and symmetric, we have to go dig you up. It's not safe to leave something like that in the ground. But at least 90 or 95% of the things get added to the dig list based on that first criteria and look like an item in the library. And here's an example of that. I think. Okay, here we go. So the unknown item that we measured is in the dash lines in the field, and the library response of a 37 millimeter projectile, is shown in the light gray. So it's pretty easy to see that those are not a match. But we also know something, because we know something about magnitudes. This thing's a lot bigger than a 37 because the amplitude's a lot bigger. So we learned something. Now let's compare it to a 105 millimeter projectile, and you can see that, I'll just click ahead to give you the answer, it doesn't match the 105 very well, but it's also smaller than the 105 because the 105 reference signatures are much bigger. So we've bounded it now. It's between the 37 and the 105. We're still feeling good that it's a munition because it has a really symmetric, one large, two small look about it. So we're thinking this is, oh, and the decay goes on for quite a long time, so we think it's thick wall. So let's try something in the middle, and it turns out it's a bang-on match to a 75-millimeter projectile. So we feel very confident saying that's a 75-millimeter projectile, and, of course, that has to be removed. Now, that took us, I'm looking at a stopwatch here, to time myself, that took us about a minute to do that. Of course, a computer can match it against all the 200 things in the library in a fraction of a second. And rather than us saying, yep, looks like it, the computer can calculate some kind of numeric metric for how well it matches. And I put those numbers up on the top of the screen there, where zero would be completely doesn't match at all. And then obviously in the case of 75 millimeter, 0.99 is quite a good match. 1.00 would be a perfect match. So you can see we can feel quite confident that things that match to ammunition with some kind of metric above 0.9 or 0.95 or bang on ammunition. And so we call this a 75, obviously. So now let's talk about that cluster idea. So here's from a field, and I actually don't remember where this is. Dean would have known, but whatever. You can see at this field, we found a lot of 155-millimeter projectiles. That's many, many, many sets of these things from different items. And you can tell they're all match to a 155, and so there were a lot of 155s. You can see on the right the so-called industry standard objects, which we use as seeds, and Ed Curl will talk about later. We had a lot of those in the field. They all have about the same signatures, so we felt comfortable with those, but we knew what those were. Here's the case, though, coming up on the next slide, where we have a whole lot of things that all look the same. The one plotted in blue is just the one that's closest to the mean of them all. They all look the same, but we don't know what they are. So this is a case where we have to go out and find out. We cannot walk away from the site not knowing what these things are. So we went and dug a couple up. I think we dug that blue one up, the one that is plotted in blue. And you can see it's a T-bar fuse. So at our site, our UXO safety person decided that these only got separated when they functioned, so they were not hazardous. So we didn't dig them up. We left them in the ground. But, of course, we know where they all are. So if at some time later we decide we have to remove them, we can go get them. If they turn out to be hazardous, of course, we would probably add them to our library as a local item that's hazardous, and then we dig them all up. And here is an example of how we would order these items. You can see they're just ordered by this metric match. Things that match very well are munitions. Things that don't match well, and in this case it looks like they use a cutoff of about 0.85 or something like that in the match for the cutoff. You'll see later on how we verify that number, so don't get too hung up on it. And so we just rank them all. We dig down till we think there's recommend not to be munitions anymore, and then we have confidence that we've cleared the site. Of course, everything we dig up, we go match it against what we expected it to be. We definitely want to make sure throughout the process that we're making sense. We don't want to dig up something that's a small sliver that we've called a 105 millimeter, because that would mean we don't know what we're talking about. So we're always checking ourselves like that, and Ed Kaur will go into a lot more detail about that. So now that brings this section to a conclusion. I'm sorry I went a minute or so over. We know how to determine which items to dig up, and now we're going to learn how few of those flags in the next couple of modules we can actually deal with. Okay, and so the next speaker to talk about site suitability is Ed Walker from California. And Ed, it's over to you.
All right, thanks, Herb. So one thing that we need to talk about is that there's a lot of people on the phone that may have experience with munitions cleanup, and there's also a lot that don't. So this is going to be good for everyone, because these new sensors function very similar to the traditional single-axis sensors. And have very similar site requirements. So to understand the site requirements, we're going to want to have a well-developed site characterization, and that may be in the form of a conceptual site model. We're also going to look at developing an achievable remedial action objective, And then we'll follow it up with a look at the operational environment. That is where we're what the field looks like and how we're going to move these sensors around in it. And then we're going to end with a discussion, a really brief discussion, and maybe an introduction to quality. And that is for the purpose of getting your team ready and understanding how classification works and having appropriate resources for them. So Herb gave a great discussion on the technology, and this slide illustrates the new Metal Mapper multi-axis sensor technology and the electromagnetic field lines on the right, but it also shows the traditional axis, single axis sensor with the field lines, and you'll notice they're very similar, and in fact they function exactly the same way, and I think Herb pointed that out. So what I'm saying is that these site considerations are going to be very similar for both technologies. As I mentioned, it's important to have a real good site characterization. So we're going to look at the conceptual site model. And through the development of this technology, it's been realized that the performance has been very related to how well the site's been characterized. And so the things that you're going to want to have in your site characterization or your conceptual site model are the land uses, both present and future, an understanding of where all the historic ranges are. You should also have well-defined munitions response sites and an understanding of the munition type and depth that exist at the site, a summary of all the work that's been conducted at the site, and all decisions that have been made up to this point. A real useful way to summarize the site is to develop a vertical conceptual site model. And the important things that this graph have in it are they have all of the munition types that are known to exist on the site, as well as the recovery depth of the deepest munition. You'll also see a dotted line, and that's representing the amplitude response detection limit. That's telling you how deep the sensor can see these munitions in the ground. With that information, we can start to talk about what's our goal, what's our remedial action objective, and then determine whether or not this technology is appropriate for your site. So it's important to have clear expectations from all the stakeholders regarding which targets are of interest, which targets are creating a hazard. And that's going to really encompass all the munitions that are known or expected to be on the site, as well as how those munitions were deployed at the site. And that's important because these munitions may potentially blow up into smaller pieces or partially explode into smaller pieces that could still be hazardous. And the reason that's important is because as you get these smaller components that are, if they're hazardous and they're similar size to munition debris that's not hazardous, we're going to have some serious performance declines. So to illustrate that, we have three photos at the bottom here. One on the left is a projectile that I think most teams would agree is hazardous and would need to be removed. In the middle, we have a subcomponent, and this is what Herb was talking about earlier. It's a T-bar fuse. Now, what's important here is that if this T-bar fuse is similar shape and size to the munition debris on the right, you may have some problems at this site because you're going to have to dig up a lot of munition debris, and you may have some there may be some issues with using the extra cost of classification if you in fact have to dig up a lot of things. So if you can get your site team to understand, or if it is in fact the T-bar fuse is not hazardous, it's important to be able to explain that to your site team and get agreement on that up front. When you're looking at your remedial action objective, it's important to know that all EMI sensors, including the single axis and multi-axis sensors, have a real challenge at detecting deeply buried small items. And that was illustrated by Herb's analogy with the echolocation. You really have problems once you get small items deep in the ground. And to illustrate that, I bring back the conceptual site model, where I have all the munition types known at the site listed. I have the deepest depths recovered. And then on the right, I have one example of the sensor response. So this example is for a 37 millimeter projectile. And it illustrates that drop-off of the signal strength with depth. And so it's important to understand what your limitations are. In this case, we see that there's a dotted line drawn, and it intersects with a 30-centimeter depth and a signal strength. So we use that signal strength to start to determine what we can accomplish at the site. We know we can detect that munition at 30 centimeters. So we plot that on our vertical conceptual sight model, and you'll see that the 37-millimeter, all the known detected munitions, the 37-millimeter, all the known detected 37-millimeters are well above that detection depth. And in fact, all the munitions known at the site are above the detection depths relative to the munition. So we know we're in really good shape here. We have a technology that's viable, and we believe that in this case we could probably get all of the munitions off this site. There's some other things that can create some problems for you at your site, and that's typical with all the sensors. But it's important to also, I think we talked about this a little earlier, that multi-axis sensors are not currently used on airborne applications, and that's because of the height problem, getting too high above the munition. And then the underwater platforms are a challenge because of the positioning. You have a height and position are both challenges in that case. So it's not real typical to see this being done in production. The key considerations we're going to go on with here are looking at the site background, and that's the geophysical noise, what's in the soil and how much noise it creates for the sensor. We're going to look at anomaly density, how many anomalies per acre can we expect to have a good result with. Vegetation, we're going to look at what vegetation problems can arise. Terrain, slope, how the sensor is deployed, what slopes can be used, and also looking at how many structures and utilities do you have on site and what kind of problems that could create. Let's start with the geophysical noise. That's just basically, if you have iron-rich soils, they're going to have a response just like a metal object would. And so we're going to have to go out and collect some site information, you know, run the sensors around and determine what that noise level is. And that's because we want that noise to be well below the signal of the items we're looking at. And in general, I believe it needs to be, the noise needs to be four to seven times below our detections. And in this case, this is real data from a site, and it ended up being 10 times below. So we know we're in good shape, but it's going to require some site-specific information. The next thing we want to talk about is density. Classification in high-density anomaly areas is difficult. And that's because a sensor, once it's in one given location at the site, it needs to identify individual anomalies underneath it. If you get too many anomalies underneath that sensor, it's just going to look like a big blob of metal, and you're not going to be able to do classification. You're just going to know that you have a lot of things to dig up in that area. So similar to single-axis sensors, these multi-axis sensors may require a different approach. You may need to go out and just use a magnetometer and some field crews and just start digging up as much metal as you can. So what we're going to do is we're going to utilize site records and detection surveys to identify these areas where we're going to have problems. So I'm just going to go over a quick example of that. This is a real-world site where transects were taken. These are the metal detectors run over at spacing of maybe 20 meters, just to give a real rough idea of the type of densities we're seeing out here. And in this case, we see this pink blob in the middle is representing anomaly densities over 4,000 anomalies per acre. And we know from experience that that's going to be a challenge. However, a lot of the site is looking pretty good, so we go ahead and send the crews out there and do a 100% detection survey. The results of that give us a much finer idea of the densities out there, and in this case, we have good news that it shrinks that area down. However, we still see a lot of pink there. So these sites are just going to require some other type of preliminary work or some other, you know, traditional sensors. We're just not going to get the production improvements that we see with the multi-axis sensors. So we'll probably draw a line around that area and send the crews out there to do something different. Local vegetation is not to be underestimated. We see a picture on the left of clear, flat ground, open skies. That's ideal. In the middle, what we have is some 12-foot tall manzanita and 6-foot tall poison oak. and we know that's going to be a problem. We can't even get in there with a sensor. On the right, we have trees, so we're going to have a hard time maneuvering a big towed array around these trees. So this is going to require maybe a handheld sensor. So not to be underestimated is the expense for clearing brush. And here you see a great example of a real nice weed eater and a big burn pile clearing that area so we can get in there and detect some munitions. So terrain is a problem. And that's because we can get these toad sensors on a tractor in slopes that are less than 20%. You know, beyond that, it's a real safety hazard, and you know, you get some tipping. In the center, I've personally pushed one of these things on about a 30% slope, and it's challenging, but it can be done. Again, it's just a real concern for your site safety officers. Beyond that, you're going to be looking at some real interesting techniques. You know, maybe rappelling down the side of a cliff or something with a sensor, and that's these handheld sensors come in handy. Another obvious problem probably is that structures and utilities are going to create a problem. On the left, we have some wire fencing. That wire fencing is going to create a response for any of your sensors, and it's going to you're not going to be able to see too much discrete metal below that. Power lines could create a problem, as well as structures and all the metal in there. The structures may just inhibit you from even getting over the ground in the first place. So those are all, you know, maybe not obvious, but there are going to be some serious problems. The last thing we want to talk about suitability is your team suitable for this? And to get your team suitable, ITRC has gone through a lot of effort to create a guidance document, as well as obviously this online training. During the development of the GCMR program, ESGCP conducted over 20 successful demonstrations, and there's a lot of documentation of that online and available. You might find a site very similar to yours, and you could read up and learn about the challenges and successes that occurred there. One of the things that you might have noticed is there's a lot of technology here and a lot of moving pieces. So the team realized that what would be real important is to get a quality assurance program in place here. And so we have a quality assurance plan in place. We have Ed Coral from NAVC in the Laboratory Quality and Accreditation Office. He joined the team quite a while ago, and I think he learned more than he ever thought he would about munitions. And so what he's going to do is return that favor in kind to you and teach you more than you ever thought you would know about quality. And so we're going to take a quick break here and do a question and answer poll, and that will be followed up by Ed.
Thanks, Ed. Everyone is welcome to send in questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right. For our participants on the phone line, it's #6 to unmute if you'd like to jump in and ask a question out loud. So a question has come in during the first half. How well does this technology do with buried frag containing white phosphorus?
So this is Herb. I can answer that. These are really, and more than really, these are only metal detectors. It would certainly be, I often, when I give talks to RABs and things about this, what we really want is, you know, the proverbial Star Trek tricorder that you can point at it and say, oh, there's explosive material. Because, of course, what we're trying to do is take care of the explosive hazard. But it's really difficult to detect white phosphorus that's buried or explosive materials that are buried. So we focus on the can, the steel or, in some cases, aluminum that they're surrounded by. So white phosphorus makes it not harder to detect, but also doesn't make it any easier to detect.
Thanks. As we're waiting for a few more questions to come in, I'll mention our feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide. So before you leave today, please fill out the feedback form. And it's available in these related links on the middle right. So it's the fourth item down. You select the name of the related link, and then you look down a bit, there's a button that says Browse To, and that's going to open those links to open in a new window. So the feedback form is your opportunity to help us improve this training class, help us improve our new munitions response training class that we're developing now. It's also allows you to get a certificate for attending today's class. So if you want a participation certificate, be sure to check the box at the bottom of the feedback form. It certifies you attended. And then once you submit, the system's going to generate that certificate for you. Has this technology been used on historic battlefields?
Actually, we have not demonstrated on historic battlefields, but it has been used with targets that I think you would find on historic battlefields. You'll have to type in and tell me whether I'm getting in the right spot, but I'm assuming we're talking about cannonballs and stuff. So you can think about that T-bar fuse I showed, which is roughly spherical. A cannonball would give the same sort of response. Huh? All three axes would be the same, so they would all three lie over each other. They're a perfect cannonball. And in fact, a lot of times people use as a calibration target either a steel sphere or a shot put. So we're very familiar with those, what those look like. They look a lot different than fragments look. So it's really easy to pick things like that out.
Does the presence of metal fencing and buried buildings anywhere near the site significantly affect the results and or eliminate the possibility of doing the survey?
No, not at all. So that's, you know, the both, we talked about one of the bad parts of these sensors is they don't see very deep, meaning the signal fires off is the sixth power of the distance. Well, that works in your favor about metal buildings and fencing. You have to be very close to them before you can start to sense their presence. So what Ed meant in that, when the slide he showed you was that if you're running right upside, like the wheels of the cart are touching the metal fence, you're definitely going to see some influence from that, and it's going to make it harder to see deep. Right up against a metal fence or right along the side of a metal building, you may have to think about another technology.
Has a case study been conducted where a geophysical survey has been conducted using both single-axis sensors and then multi-axis sensors, and the results compared? Specifically, has there been a site that has been fully dug to verify results?
Absolutely. That's a very good question, and that was the way we conducted all of the ESTCP demonstrations. We dug everything in those cases, because when you're trying to prove the technology out, you got to find out whether it really works. So in those cases, we would do a single-axis sensor. Some of you may be familiar with this sensor called the EM61, which is used a lot, these orange rectangles you see on these sites. We found all the anomalies using the EM61, and then we made a decision on them based on the results from these advanced sensors, the multi-axis sensors, and then we dug everything. And that's how we proved that in all cases, we can find 100% of the munitions and eliminate something like 80% of the clutter.
And we can find links to more information on those in the document?
Absolutely. I think there's a reference in the document to the ESTCP website, which shows you all that, where that map came from that Ed showed, and also Fred, and you can get individual reports on all of those sites.
What is the cost per acre?
Well, that's a sort of a hard thing to say because it depends on the density, huh? If you're just doing I showed the mowing the grass method to find anomalies, that cost is just about the same as it would cost to do a hand-pushed EM61 because the widths are about the same and you can walk just about as fast. So I actually don't know what people charge for that. So there's no extra cost to do the anomaly detection using these advanced sensors. But if the second step is you go and sit on top of each detection, which I'll show you in the case study, and make a decision, then if there's 100 per acre, you know, in your 1 acre plot, you got to do that 100 times. If there's 2,000 per acre, you got to do that 2,000 times. It's something like $35 to $40 to make a cued measurement and analyze it, make a decision. You normally contrast that for something like $125 to dig a target on a munition site. So it's about one-third the cost. So you definitely, if you can avoid a lot of digs, you can make money doing this.
Thank you. We'll wrap up this question and answer break. People are welcome to send in questions throughout the second half of the training. We do hope to have time at the end to ask more questions out loud, and in some cases we'll get back to you through that Q&A pod with answers. For now, we'll continue on with the second half of the training, and I'm going to turn the presentation over to Ed Coral at the NAVSEA Laboratory Quality and Accreditation Office.
Thank you, Juliana. Appreciate that. So let's talk about quality considerations, and this first slide is really a summary of what the previous speakers have already provided, and that is with the single-axis sensors, and following the historical application of mag and slag and dig, if you will, that operation is very labor-intensive and it's very cost-prohibitive. So these new sensors allow us, of course, the ability to detect and classify munitions, munition items sort of a priori, so that we can remove the items that might represent an explosive hazard while leaving the inert items behind. So why do we care about quality? That's kind of a rhetorical question, but so if we have these powerful sensors and they've already been proven, why do we need to worry about quality? Well, just like the laboratory instruments that are used for chemical testing, all instruments have limitations, and they also must be calibrated, and they have to be used correctly. So how do we increase our confidence in being able to use this instrumentation? So here on slide 72, if we all take a step back for just a moment from munitions and think about a typical chemical investigation, something maybe we're all more familiar with. And if I were to poll this group, if I were to poll each and every one of you, and if we were to come up with a list of quality-related processes or quality-related actions or indicators that you typically use or associate with increasing your confidence in chemical data, we would probably come up with a list that includes these items. Now, this isn't a comprehensive list, but obviously things like making sure our sampling is representative, that we have accuracy and precision, and if there's QC samples that are involved, the laboratory can run for us. And what about detection limits? Do we have a way to perform some data verification and validation? What about, do we have trained analysts that are using standardized methods, and do they have demonstrated capabilities? And is there an accreditation program for that laboratory? So all these are really, really important aspects that we might associate with increasing our confidence. So what I hope to convey over the next 20 minutes or so is that we've actually incorporated all of these concepts and much, much more into the Advanced Geophysical Classification, or AGC, process. And those are captured in the ITRC document as well. A quick point about, or clarification about QA and QC. The quality control is a product or a metric-oriented aspect of quality, and that would be things like accuracy and precision, while quality assurance is sort of a process-oriented aspect. So that would be things like verifying that we're following SOPs as written and that we have validation processes in place. So both of these, the QA and QC, is really necessary to increase our confidence because it ensures both the processes and the products and the goals from those are planned for, we monitor them, and we also verify that they're going to meet our project goals. So here on slide 73 are the specific quality sections in the ITRC document. Due to the time limitations, I'll only be able to discuss a few of these items that are bolded here in subsections 4.3 and 4.4. Section 4.3 describes and cross-references a companion document that was developed out of the IDQTF, which is the AGC QAP. This document specifies worksheets following the USP QAP format that many of you might be familiar with, but it's tailored specifically for munitions using advanced geophysical classification. Section 4.4 provides an overview of an accreditation program that has been established, and I'll provide all of you a quick overview of that program as well towards the end of the presentation. So real quick, here on slide 74, a little bit about the AGC QAP. Now, this, of course, is not a training session specifically on the AGC QAP, but it has to be mentioned because the ITRC document follows and references key respective worksheets and processes to specific QA/QC aspects that are listed in the ITRC document. So the AGC QAP was developed by a federal interagency work group, that's the IDQTF, that consisted of state and federal regulatory partners, as well as a whole group of experts in the field of munitions. It contains a template and SOPs for planning and completing a munitions investigation using advanced geophysical classification. Part of building that QAP template, we actually included some beta testing and some lessons learned at a site in Colorado. And then the document went final, I think, in early 2016, and it is available on the IDQTS website. But so here on slide 75, the sections in the ITRC document are designed to follow the natural progression of steps of an investigation, starting with project planning. Now, during the initial phases of systematic planning, the entire project team, including our regulatory partners, will start with building the conceptual site model and the problem statement. So 4.3.1 in the ITRC document outlines the quality considerations that are initiated and documented in these early phases of planning. And that's as specified in the AGC QAP worksheets 9, 10, and 11. Worksheet 9 is basically just a place to document key decisions of meetings and or agreements by the project team, while worksheets 10 and 11 document the conceptual site model and the data quality objective processes, respectively. Here on slide 76, so project planning should follow a simple but linear process, such as the data quality objective process that was developed by the EPA, which is a seven-step process. The Army's TPP process follows a very similar track. Worksheet 10 should always be part of those initial discussions, as it provides the foundation for the problem statement and is the first step, really, of the DQO process. So Worksheet 10 is a summary of the conceptual site model, provides a review of the past, the present, and the future activities and use of the site, the receptors that are present, the known or suspected munitions that were used, the firing points, the target areas, and that type of relevant information. The site model, of course, may change as information becomes available during the course of investigation. So the site model is updated as we go through the process. Worksheet 11 documents the remaining DQO steps 2 through 7. And the outputs of Worksheet 11, that is the outputs of the DQO process, really establish the QNQC for the project and also the sampling design and the sampling approach for the investigation. Finally, a quick plug for Chapter 3 of the ITRC document. It provides a wonderful overview of the type of things that project teams should consider during the initial planning, and I certainly will refer all of you to that excellent resource in our document. So here on slide 77, we felt a need for clarification on the difference between measurement performance criteria and measurement quality objectives. We get a lot of questions about these, and we continue to get a lot of questions. I know it's a tad confusing. So we thought it was definitely a good idea to make some clarification here. So so both MPCs and MQOs are listed, of course, both in the ITRC document and in the AGC QAP as well. Both MPCs and MQOs involve quality criteria. And some of you might be familiar with the old acronym PARCS that we use for chemical testing. For precision, accuracy, representativeness, completeness, comparability, and sensitivity. And all of these are historically referred to as data quality indicators as well, or DQIs. So what are the differences? Well, measurement performance criteria, or MPCs, are captured on AGC QAP worksheet number 12. And these address requirements for overall project performance. So these criteria will ultimately be used to assess, or part of the assessment, of the quality goals in terms of whether we have met specific project needs. MQOs are also criteria. These are measurement quality objectives, and they are documented on worksheet 22 of the AGC QAP. And they document procedures for performance, testing, inspections, and quality control. But specifically for field data collection activities. So these are the criteria specifically for what's going on in the field. So we can also recover from failed MQOs as well, but the affected data must be addressed, and we have to perform a root cause analysis, and we have to perform corrective actions as well. So more simply, in summary, so Worksheet 12, MPCs, are project quality criteria, and failures can really affect our ability to meet project goals. Worksheet 22, the MQOs, are field activities, but we can recover from failed MQOs. So these are the same sort of practices that we also use in chemistry laboratories as well. All right, so moving on to slide 78, section 432 provides quality considerations involved in site preparation activities as part of our investigation. So on the right, you're seeing just a few examples of the type of MQOs, or measurement quality objectives, like the IVS accuracy, and I'll provide a little bit more information on the IVS in just a moment, things like inline spacing, polarizability requirements, and the like. So these would be documented on worksheet 22-1, which are specific to preparation activities, site preparation activities. So here on slide 79, this is just a screenshot right out of the AGC CLAP of worksheet 22. So notice that there are entries for, number one, defining the type of measurement quality objective that we're listing here. It references a specific sampling, a standard operating procedure, or what we call a DFW, which is a definable feature of work that's in the process that we use in the process of performing an investigation. It also provides the frequency of that quality objective and also what the specific acceptance criteria are. It also has entries for who's responsible for verifying each and every MQO and whether that MQO has been met, and also the failure response. Remember, we can recover from a failed MQO, but we have to do a corrective action, and it has to be documented. All right, so if Juliana can, I think, start a macro for me here. I think Herb actually showed you a very similar diagram earlier. So here on this slide, this is just an example of an MQO for representativeness and completeness in terms of site coverage. So, of course, we can't classify an item if we don't detect it first. So this pictorial is a visualization of during the detection survey. And sometimes it's referred to as mowing the lawn. You heard Herb mention that. Because the instruments also carry GPS, we can follow both the inline and the cross track, that is the between row spacing, to ensure that we have adequate overlap, right, so that we don't have any potential items that are missed in the course of the detection survey. And we can establish specific MQOs for representativeness and also for completeness. Okay, so I had previously mentioned the IVS. The IVS is an instrument verification strip. Here on slide 81 is just a description of the instrument verification strip. So the IVS is another quality metric that's used during geophysical classification investigations. The primary purpose of the IVS is to ensure that the instrumentation is operating properly. So the IVS is evaluated usually at the start and the end of each day at a minimum and consists of two lanes. One will be a designated lane for planting some IVS items consisting of either inert munitions or industry standard objects. You had heard Ed refer to this. And these act basically as surrogates. So they're typically spaced about 5 meters apart. The other lane is used to monitor background for evaluating ambient noise. And we can set MQOs for the activities as part of the IVS evaluations. As demonstrate on this next slide. So here on slide 82, we can set and monitor acceptance criteria or MQOs for both accuracy, that is ground truth positioning accuracy for each surrogate item in the IVS, that's shown on the right. In addition to that, we can also establish an MQO for precision for the items as well. So on the left, we see a plot of repeated ground truth results specifically for item 4. And we can establish MQOs for both accuracy and precision for the IVS items. On slide 83 here, the next phase of the advanced geophysical classification investigation process is the CUED survey. So the quality considerations for the CUED survey are provided in 433 of the document, the ITRC guide, and also on worksheet 22-2 of the AGC CLAP. And you can see, again, there's some examples in the bullets on the right-hand side. And it includes things like our IVS library match metric. We can set MQOs for that. Our GPS benchmark positioning. Also on background thresholds and representativeness and also comparability for polarizability matches, those things that Herb led us through earlier. And also an introduction of the importance of completeness for our seeds, which I'll explain here in just a moment. Okay, so I'm going to spend a little bit of extra time here on this slide because of the vast importance of seeds, as you can see on my corny animation here to bring your attention to this. Seeds play really a critical role in the quality of geophysical classification projects. So seeds are analogous to control check samples that are performed by laboratories performing chemical analysis, and they're basically inert items or munition surrogates that we place on site, just like in the IDS. There are two types of seeds. There are QC seeds that are in place by the production team, that is the contractor that's doing the measurements for us. And also there are QA or validation seeds, and these are in place by the government or a third party. So the seeds provide ongoing monitoring to ensure each step leading to the product is working, because we're planting these seeds actually in the areas where we're performing the analysis. So we have, from the detection of varied items through the classification, these seeds help us to make sure that we're monitoring that performance. And it's a vital part of measuring the overall success of our project. So seeds are typically placed so that two or three are usually encountered by each acquisition team in the course of the day. So what are the differences? The QC seeds, which again are in place by the contractor's QC personnel, are usually placed at horizontal and vertical locations and orientations that meet or even exceed our overall performance criteria. Failure of a QC seed can be investigated and corrected by the contractor. Now, validation or QA seeds are in place at depth well within the project limits of the site, and failure to detect a blind validation seed actually is a very serious flaw and may have drastic negative impact on our data usability. So in these cases, a failure of a validation seed, we should probably stop work and consider which data might have even been affected by the failure of that validation seed. So a failure of a validation seed is a big deal. And validation seed failures are also monitored for purposes of the accreditation program, which I'll tell you a little bit more in just a little while. So they are basically the equivalent of proficiency test samples for those organizations that have been accredited in our program. So passing the validation seeds really will be a condition of accreditation. So in summary, seeds really are sort of blind QC checks, if you will. So the QC seeds are sort of single blind checks that are in place by the contract QC personnel at depths and orientations that meet or even exceed our project goals. The failure of the QC seed can be investigated and it can be corrected. QA seeds, or validation seeds, are in place by the government or a government's representative, and they're basically double blinds, if you will. So, and a failure of a validation seed can be a very serious thing. All right, so moving on to slide 85, for the intrusive investigation identified in 434 of the IPRC document, again, we identify specific NQOs for equipment testing, inspection, and quality control. These are documented in worksheet 22-3 in the AGC QAP. And examples, again, are listed here on the right, such as criteria for ground truth size and matching of our targets of interest, and even our non-TOIs as well. We will include a completeness check NQO for our stop big threshold verification as well. More on that in just a moment. So here on slide 86, so how do we verify and validate the overall process? So once we have all of the detection and the classification data, the anomalies are ranked. Herb showed you this a little bit earlier, that we have this ranked anomaly list according to their match or fit with the library. And you're seeing that match metric or that list on the vertical scale here on the far left. So the last item on the dig list, target for removal, lies on this dig, no dig decision point. And it really represents the item on the dig list where the least amount of certainty in terms of classification of a munition lies. So as an added level of conservatism, we have instituted that an additional 200 what we call threshold verification targets below the last target of interest are intrusively investigated. So this is a verification of that no dig or stop dig threshold to protect against false negatives, right? Because that's what we're all concerned about. We don't want to leave something in the ground that really does represent an explosive hazard that we call a non-TOI. So if any of these 200 additional threshold verification targets show up to be munitions of concern, the threshold is adjusted and the process is repeated, right? So now, in addition to that, we also have 200 non-TOI, what we call validation digs, that are also performed. And we perform these randomly on 200 selected non-TOIs. That's the rest of these items that you're seeing on the far right. These are the items that we have classified as non-TOI. That is, items that we have earmarked for being inert and we can leave in the ground. So this step is the validation of the entire process. It really is a validation of both false positives and false negatives. And we intrusively investigate these 200 random non-TOIs and confirm that the reasons why we classify them as inert are in fact true. So it is a validation of the overall detection classification process. The 200 number for both these added digs were discussed and agreed upon by the IDQF team. We get this question all the time, where did the 200 number come from? And basically, these really were arbitrary numbers that we came up with. But these were numbers that the entire project team came up with, again, with our regulatory partners, as being conservative to help us prevent against false negatives and false positives, but also not to be too intrusive in terms of being cost prohibitive. Here on slide 87, advanced geophysical classification involves a lot of, I guess you could call it dynamic decision making, and there's a lot of data that's being generated. So that data has to be documented. We have to manage it, we have to review it, and we have to validate it, and it's also a key part of quality consideration. So ITRC section 535 and worksheet 29 of the AGC CLAP provides minimum specifications for data management tasks. Things like interim and final deliverables that we put together, and procedures for controlling project documents, records, and the databases that are utilized. So its purpose is to ensure data completeness, data integrity, and also ease of retrieval. Section 436 of the ITRC document describes the three basic phases of data review, and these are addressed in worksheets 34 through 37 of the AGC CLAP. So the CLAP must document the inputs needed for the appropriate data review. That's documented on worksheet number 34. Verification on worksheet 35 is a check that everything that was supposed to be done has in fact been completed as planned. And AGC CLAP worksheet 36 is an evaluation of whether specific results conform to stated criteria that we developed as part of the CLAP. So finally, worksheet 37, we call a data usability assessment, or DUA. And it basically takes all of the information from the verification and validation and determines that the overall data that has been acquired supports the objectives, especially the MPCs, and if our conceptual site model is still current, such that we can make a decision and we can finalize the investigation. Switching gears just a little bit, the DoD's Environmental Data Quality Work Group has developed an accreditation program for activities performing geophysical investigations. So the accreditation program follows a similar platform that we use for chemical laboratories. It uses a third-party accrediting bodies. The accreditation program, called the DAGCAP, it requires analysts that have documented qualifications, training. It requires them to demonstrate their capabilities in using the instrumentation. It's a platform providing a formal recognition for competent testing organizations. It requires successful detection and classification of a validation feed, which is, again, are going to be monitored. The organizations must perform internal audits and document their corrective actions, and also including process improvements and making sure that we will prevent reoccurrence of problems. So these are all conditions of their accreditation. So overall, this helps us to enhance confidence and results by for our clients, our regulators, and the public. I think we currently have about nine or 10 organizations that are currently accredited under this program. So in summary here on slide 89, as I discussed earlier, all the quality assurance and quality control steps that we normally associate with increasing our confidence in data are already built into the geophysical classification program and are summarized in Section 4 of the ITRC document. The CERTIP and ESCC program, they did a great job at developing, validating, and proving that this technology works and that it is ready for mainstream use. But the instruments, just like those performing chemical analysis, have their limitations. But as long as we utilize initial project scoping through the use of systematic planning, using the AGC CLAP template, we implement QAQC, and together with the implementation of the accreditation program, we can increase our ability to use this technology effectively, and the organizations performing the work can give us what we need to make our project decisions. So collectively, these steps will produce data that meet the needs of the DoD and will allow all the federal partners, include our regulatory entities, to have confidence in quick decision-making. The ITRC, we are in the process of actually going through and updating this current guidance that originally came out in 2008. I believe we're dated to have this actual released in May, and we're developing a training course for this as well. So that should be coming out very, very soon. With that said, I'm going to turn this over to my good friend Herb Nelson, who's going to lead us through a case study. So over to you, Herb.
Thank you very much, Ed. So I know there's a lot here, particularly if this is your first exposure to this technology, so it's been coming pretty quick, but that's really the end of the new material. What we hope to do in this case study is just bring it all together and show you how it works on a site that is really a composite of several of our ESCCB demonstration sites, but I think we'll illustrate all the things you've seen so far today. So let's take a look at quick look at the site. It's in coastal California. As you can see, it's owned by a university now, so there's really no access restrictions. There's cattle grazing on the site. There's geotechnical classes on the site. And it's a really very nice place. You can see the ocean. You get a nice sea breezes, so there's a lot of people camping and hiking on the site. Lots of public access. So like many of these sites that were World War II and Korean War training facilities, there are a number of overlapping range fans. Some of these were used. Some of them were just planned. The records are not all that good, so you don't really know. You have an idea what was used at the site, but you're not certainly sure. So your initial CSM is a little hazy. Based on the RRI data, which has just been completed, we see that we have an MRS of about 2,500 acres. And you can see a lot of the valleys and hillsides, which is obvious as places to be training and shooting against, are included in this thing. So over the years, there have been a number of UXO found on this site, the people working, the agricultural students out there, the geotechnical students. So you can see there's been a number of reports, and those were always taken care of by on removals as they were found. So it's clearly we got to get this site cleaned up because there's a lot of public access to things that could be dangerous. So as like all these sites, we don't have enough money to clean the whole thing up the first year. We only have about money to do 100 acres the first year. And so there's the 100 acres we've chosen. It's right near where there's a lot of access. A lot of camping goes on in that area, and there's also been some finds in that area. So it's a good place for us to start. So here's a real quick history. I've already given a lot of this away. It was established in the 20s, really expanded like a lot of these sites through World War II and Korea, and then transferred to private owners. There was a PA and SI early on. There's been several time critical removal actions as they found things. The remedial investigation was started in 2011, but the report wasn't published until 2015. So as these things go, it's going pretty quickly, although pretty quickly, it's pretty slow. So we've talked several times, and Ed Walker talked to you about this. There's really two things we want to know. Here's a map that was developed from the RI detections that shows you the spatial distribution of the munitions and explosives of concern that were found. And you can see there's two targets that are right near our site, which is why we chose the 100 acres that we're going to clean up today. There's a lot of action right in those. And I said today, I'm sorry, this summer, or this field season is when we're going to do this 100-acre cleanup. It'd be nice if we could do it in a day, but we can't do it that quickly. But the other half of this is, as Ed also pointed out to you, is both the spatial extent and the vertical extent. So you can see on this slide, the stars show the deepest recovered example of each of the unexploded ordnance or munitions types that are shown on this slide. Most of them are pretty shallow. and the little dashed lines show the amplitude response depth limit. So if we were finding things deeper than that, we might be in trouble, but we're not. We can everything's much shallower, and in the next set of slides, you'll understand why that is. Up on the hilltops, there's really very little soil overlapping. There's only about a foot of soil, and then it's bedrock. So clearly, things can't get any deeper than than about a foot up on the hilltops. And even down in the valleys between the hills, there's something like just about not quite a meter, 3 feet-ish sort of soil. So this is a site that's going to be good for us to make an indecision on, because there really is a limit of how deep munitions can get. And in most places, we can detect them as deep as they can get or deeper. So we'll feel pretty confident at the end that we've been able to clear the site. Okay, so the remedial objective, as was outlined in the contract that we gave to our contractor, and also as we developed with the rest of the site team, is to detect and dispose of munitions that can be detected using a detection threshold, looking for 37-millimeter projectiles at 12 inches, and to do this as efficiently as possible. So there's a couple of important things that you read into that. Number one is any munition that we detect, no matter how deep it is, we're obliged to remove it. And number two is as efficiently as possible means the most economical method possible. That's likely to drive us to use advanced geophysical classification. Not in all cases, but in this case, of course, it will, since we're in an advanced geophysical classification training session. So here's a quick calculation of the cost that we expect for this project. You can see these are 2015 numbers, but I don't think things have changed a whole lot. There's a ton of stuff on this slide. You can go back and look more carefully at the individual items. We gave you up above all the costs that the individual cost items we did. You can compare them to experiences you've had. But really what we want to focus on is the bottom lines of this. We calculate to do our 100-acre site here would cost about $6.5 million doing the traditional approach. And we estimated before we start that it's going to be about $3.5 million to do this site through using classification methods or advanced geophysical classification. So therefore, there's a significant saving, you know, something like 50%, not quite 50%. We can save a lot of money doing this using classification. So, of course, that's what we're going to do. So Ed Walker talked to you a little bit about this. This is really an ideal site for this. There's unobstructed sky view, so we can use GPS and get very good geolocation. There's pretty steep terrain. You know, you take these pictures and it doesn't really give you a good view. Some of the slopes out here are up to 20% on these hillsides. So it's not really safe to use something tractor-borne or tractor-pushed. You have a real roll hazard. So we've chosen to use this cart-pushed system that was referred to as the Temtets 2x2. Nowadays, you can buy the commercial version of this, the Metal Mapper 2x2. And we're using RTK GPS, so we'll have good centimeter level positioning. Okay, so the first step, of course, in these things is to have the first TPP meeting. And at the TPP meeting, we all come around and we make sure we're in agreement on the remedial objective. I've already shown you that we did. We talk about the survey lane spacings that it'll take to meet that remedial objective. We talk about how we're going to select anomalies. And in this case, we're going to do something that hasn't been talked about up until now, so I guess there is something new here. We're going to use a method called informed source selection, which is a way to make a cleverer choice of anomalies. I'll illustrate that for you. We talk about the schedule. We talk about all the kind of things you do at the initial TPP meeting. And then the contractor develops the QAP, and we get to work. So that's the next slide, of course. The GCMR QAP is based on the template that Ed Coral talked to you about in detail that you can get off of IDQTF website. This is actually one older version because these slides are a little old, but you can get the most recent version off the website to get started with. And as we go through, we'll talk about what's in our QAP and where we and how we made decisions. So here's the project workflow, and it's a little analogous to how Ed Coral talked to you. We've talked already, the TPP, we developed the QAP. As we go through the items on the left-hand side, site prep through verification and validation, there's some indication here of the definable features of work, that's DFWs. I've given a few example tasks that we'll talk about in each of these stages. There certainly may be more, but these are the big ones. And we've also tried to give an indication of the kind of work product you would get, when you would expect a tech memo, when you might submit a QC submittal, things like that. And we'll talk through those as we go through this project. So we're going to start with site prep, which is the first item after the TPP. And step number one is a surface clearance. We almost always do a surface clearance on when we do these sites. Number one, it's a safety issue. It allows then to for the geophysical crew to be out there without a EOD escort. But another thing is, there's actually two more things. It really teaches the analyst something. We might, in fact, find evidence of munitions we didn't expect from our CSM. That would be very important for the analyst. And the very bottom line thing, it's a very big opportunity for a cost savings. It's a lot cheaper for people walking over the site to pick things up and put them in a bucket than it is to find them as an anomaly, go back out and queue them, and then make a decision on them. So everything we can pick up from the surface is just going to help us get to the bottom line less expensively. So here is the result of our surface clearance memo, and I'll highlight that. We're excited to see that last line in the table. There were no unexpected munitions. Our CSM told us that there might be 81-millimeter mortars. We didn't find any evidence of those from the surface sweep. That, of course, certainly doesn't mean that they're not there. But the most important thing is we didn't find anything we didn't expect. So we had a pretty good CSM going into this. So as Ed talked about, we're going to put a lot of seeds out. The contractor has chosen to put about 200 QC seeds. They are going to use 37-millimeter projectiles, which is on the left down there at the bottom, and these small industry-standard objects, which are really just surrogate 37s on the right-hand side down there. And that's only because it's really tough to come up with 200 in their 37-millimeter projectiles. And you can go to Home Depot and buy all of those things on the right you want to buy. And they're like $3, so that's really the way to go. So this is all documented on Worksheet 17 of the CRAB. The contractor chose to place their seeds at 6 depths down to the maximum detection depth in the performance work statement, which was 30 centimeters, if you remember. So they put them at 5, 10, 15, 20, et cetera, down to 30 centimeters. And so the UXO geophysicist will then, of course, monitor the detection and the classification performance of these seeds. And if there are any problems, hopefully uncover that during the using those data. As Ed said also, the government places so-called validation seeds or QA seeds. This is not in the QAP because that's open to everybody on the team. This is documented in the quality assurance surveillance plan that the government holds. In this case, the government is also going to put about 200 seeds in this 100-acre area. Small ISOs, 37-millimeter projectiles, and some mortars, some of the bigger targets that we expect to find out there. The ISOs and the 37s will be down to only 30 centimeters because that's the performance work statement detection depth. But the mortars can get deeper and can be detected deeper. So the government has chosen to place the mortars at a deeper depth as for their validation seeds. And then the last piece of site prep is putting together this instrument verification strip that people talked about. This is, in this case, it looks like we're using 4 items in 1 blank spot. So you see they're being measured in carefully where they are. Those are the items that we, the photographs at the bottom of the items as they're getting ready to go into the hole, 2 ISOs and 2 37-millimeter, 37-millimeter projectiles. And so this is going to be used for a lot of things. So here is one of the things, and Ed already talked to you about this, is the sensor functioning properly? Is the location system working well, and are we ready to collect data? So if you see on the right-hand side of this slide is the actual data collected. The rightmost of those multi-path things is over the targets themselves, and you can see there are detections where they're buried, what the little X's are. And Ed talked to you about having the noise line or the site noise characterization line, which is off to the left in that plot, and that's a single pass, well away from any targets where we can get an idea of the background noise. And then on the left side of this plot is showing this first time that we did it, where are we located compared to where the item, where does the system think they're located compared to where the actual items are. And you can see they're well within our 25-centimeter spec. So we're doing a good job on locating them. The location system's working. The detection's working. So we're really almost ready to go. I want to talk a little bit, though, about this noise strip, because this is a very important thing. We want to make sure that we can actually achieve the remedial objective. And this is really our last chance to find that out before we go spend a whole bunch of money taking surveys in the field. So here is, I'm going to get my picker here. So here is two different sizes of 37s that we've been found on this site. One's a little bit bigger, one's a little bit smaller. And on the right-hand side of this slot is plotted the expected signal for those two. One's the little bit bigger one, of course, has a little higher signal, a little bit smaller one has a smaller signal, as a function of depth. So if you will remember, we said that our remedial objective is to detect these things at 30 centimeters, which means we have to be able to detect them. We have to be able to see things down to the response of the smallest one at 30 centimeters, which turns out to be 1.7 millivolts per amp, which is the units this thing reports in. Now, we can determine some noise from that site noise level, and as Ed Walker talked to you, if the noise was really high, we might have trouble doing this. Fortunately, this is a very quiet site. The noise we measure is about 0.14 millivolts per amp, more than an order of magnitude smaller than a detection threshold. We usually use the sort of 5, 6, 7, something like that, the multiplier needed for a successful detection. We're well above that, so we'll have no trouble in this case meeting our remedial objective. If, however, we were in Hawaii, that noise might be way up here, or even if we were really lucky, it might be there, barely below the detection amplitude. Then we have to go back, reconvene the site team, and decide whether it's worth going on. Are we going to learn enough here to make it worth it? Because we're not going to be able to detect things down to 30 centimeters deep. Okay, so we passed here. This is all good. In fact, it's better than good. It's really low noise site. So now we can move on, and we can start doing our detection survey. So I showed you result. Ed showed you the actual animation of doing back and forth, mowing the grass. Here is a very small piece of that site. You can see it's 90 meters on a side, or I guess it's 90 by 60 meters, that shows you the detection signal. And every one of those little numbers, every one of those colored dots is something that's a response above our 1.7 millivolts per amp threshold. So you can see there's a whole lot of colored dots in there. And, in fact, this is even not fine enough looking at, so I'm going to blow it up one more time. And about two slides from now, what we really want to talk about, though, is the two different selection methods. So method number one, which is what's used in the single-axis sensors, is just an amplitude threshold. You set that 1.7 millivolts per amp. Every time the signal is higher than that, you put a flag in the ground, and that's what gets you to that sea of flags that was shown by Fred in the beginning. The problem with that is, remember that the signal falls off very fast with depth, and so very small things real near the surface give you a relatively high amplitude signal, in many cases higher amplitude than a big munition item deep does. So if you only use an amplitude threshold, you really end up selecting a lot of frag right at the surface. Now, that's fine. You can go out and dig them, but, of course, it costs money to dig all those things or to queue over them to decide not to dig them. So one way to avoid that is to use what's called informed source selection, which is to do an analysis on the dynamic data as you go by, not maybe good enough analysis to decide whether you can leave it in the ground or not, but to get a rough idea of its depth and size. And then maybe, using this method, we can not do things that are the sizes of our fingernail that just happen to be on the surface that are way, way smaller than any munition we would care about. So this is a site team decision whether or not to use this process. Our site team has decided it's a good idea. So we're only going to flag anomalies that are big enough to be the smallest TOI, which in this case is a 37-millimeter projectile. Okay, so now let's go to that blown-up area. This is one of those little things. So now we're only 15 meters on a side. In fact, it's a quarter of one of those little grids that we've shown before. So here's an example. If we use the amplitude threshold only, there's a little flag symbol on top of everything that we would have to go cue or consider. And there's a lot of really small stuff out there and, of course, some big things that we really have to pay attention to. If we use this informed source selection method, you can see how many remain, only the big things. Now, that in this little grid, we did really well doing this. Over the whole site, it turned out we reduced our detections by about 50%. So we cut them in half. Now, this is a system, of course, that we have to, like everything we do, we have to prove that it's effective. And so in a number of grids, we did both methods and then queued over everything to prove that we were right. And we never had any problems where a munition item or a QA or QC seed was rejected by informed source selection. So we spent a significant amount of time validating that this was a legitimate thing to do, and in this case it was a legitimate thing to do. So we will take that 50% savings right off the top, and that will really help us get this done. Okay, so as we do detection, we of course have all sorts of QC checks to make, some of those that Ed Curl talked to you about. And here's a case where we have a metric that we must find all of our QC seeds within 40 centimeters. So mostly it looks good, but if you notice up there in the upper left, I think I highlighted there, yeah, up in the upper left, one of our items is outside of our QC limit. So this is a problem, huh? The QC geophysicist finds this. They go back and look at the data, and it turns out, remember I told you this is a very high-sloped area, that in one of the half a day's worth of work, the angle measuring system, the inertial measurement unit, was not recording correctly. So as you can imagine, you take the thing and tip it over 20 or so degrees, the GPS antenna moves substantially, and that wasn't being corrected for because we weren't gathering the angle data. So there's a whole day's worth of data that had to be retaken. They go back and recollect those data, and you can see that item jumps right back into where it should be. So the QC seeds were very successful in this case. A problem was identified, a correction was developed, applied, and away we go, and now we have detected all of our QC seeds within the required distance. So now we've done informed source selection. We have a whole list of anomalies to take a look at, and so now we just start banging them out. So this shows you a small piece of it. On the left-hand side is a person in the field pushing the sensor. You can see the flags. It looks nothing like the sea of flags that Fred showed you because we've already taken half of them away using informed source selection, but there's still a lot of them out there. And here's the here's along as they're taking the data. You can see them, the files just start showing up in the directory on the computer. We have a QC requirement that we take a background measurement, that is a measurement not over any sample, once every 2 hours. And the reason you have to do that is because these things are metal detectors, but they have metal wires and metal switches and metal connectors in them. So there is some signal from the sensor itself. So once each 2 hours, we take a measurement over a site that has no targets below it, and we get the measure, we get the response of the soil, if there's any. There's very little out here, but in some cases there's more, and the sensor, and then we subtract that from all our other measurements. So you can see, I'm looking at it actually on a pretty small screen, but I think that's only a little over an hour they went between those measurements. So they're well within inside their two-hour QC limit on that. And then there were several teams doing this. There's only a photograph for one, so we just bang around on this for 3 or 4 weeks collecting data over all these targets. So, of course, in the queue data, there's another QC check. In this case is to make sure we find the location of the seeds after the queue data is taken. And in this case, the specification is a lot better, 25 centimeters, a lot tighter, 25 centimeters, because once we've taken static data, we should do a lot better job, and you can tell we have. This I've switched to over the, instead of the contract QC data, I'm showing you the results over the government validation data. But the results are the same for the QC data. You see it's very tightly crusted. Almost all of them are within 10 centimeters, which is what we expect. And I think they're all within 20 centimeters. Yes, they are. So they're all well within their 25-centimeter QC limit. And that, as many of these things, you see up in the upper right of this slide, was documented on worksheet 22 of the CRAP. Okay, so now we're on. We've collected Q data over, in fact, 25,000 items. So now we're on to making some decisions. We got to classify the anomalies, decide what needs to be removed from the site and what doesn't. So I talked to you when I gave Dean's portion of this talk about the so-called clusters, meaning items that have a lot that all look the same in an EMI sense, and we have to decide what to do with them. Well, here's a cluster. It was numbered cluster number 22. It turned out there were 18 of these on the site, and you can see all of them look the same. That matches very carefully a 37-millimeter projectile, so we're good on those. We expected to remove those. Those are all dug. Here's another cluster that has 41 matches. You can see it doesn't look quite as symmetric, and the width of the spread of the curves is a little bit higher, so it's probably a little less symmetric than the 37, excuse me, but about the same size. Unfortunately, I clicked and showed you what it was before I said that, but about the same size. So you can see that we went and dug one of those, and it's a piece of frag about the same size as the 37, but not any kind of symmetric. So those items we can reject, and we can leave those in the ground. So we do that to resolve all the clusters, and now we finally have what I talked to, and maybe not use the word ranked anomaly list, and definitely Ed Curl talked to you and used the ranked anomaly list. This is the decision metric plotted on the y-axis and the anomaly number, cumulative anomaly number, plotted on the x-axis. So you can see we took data over a little over 25,000 anomalies. Some of them matched almost exactly, those ones on the left of the library. Some of them matched almost not at all, those ones over on the right of the library. So we have high confidence on the left and low confidence on the right that they're munitions. Right? You say it the other way, we have high confidence they're not munitions on the right. So we have said and agreed with our team that we will set the threshold at 0.85. So that looks to me like we have to, what, dig up like 2,500 things or something like that that we would mark to dig. So we've already are going to reject 90% of the clutter. But it's actually even better than that because, it turns out it's 2,800. Okay, still, it's a big number. It's still a pretty small number compared to the number of items. But that's even better because remember we already rejected about 25,000 through ISS. So really, and using classical methods, you'd have had to dig 50-something thousand holes on this site, and we think we're going to get away digging 2,800. Excuse me. Okay, so I've blown the part up where we're going to dig, so you can see it better now, and it is 2,800, you can see, down to about 0.85. So let's go do some digging. So there are all the things we're going to do, classified by what they were. So you can see up on the beginning where the matches were really high, they're almost all targets of interest, actual munitions. And as you get down toward lower matches, there's a few targets of interest in there, but they're mostly clutter. And that's how it ought to be, huh? The targets of interest match really well to the library, and the clutter doesn't match that well, although in this case, compared to the world, it matched pretty well. So as we said, each of these items that we pull out of the ground, we're going to take a look at, and we're going to make sure that we understand it compared to what our analysis was. That shows this, the big X's, the large stars, I mean, show the seeds. Excuse me, the UXO, everything else is a seed. I'm sorry, I got that backwards. So let's go back and forth between those. You can see those are all the things that turned out to be TOI. Those are all the things that turned out to be UXO. So by my eye, the UXO is just about as hard to find as the seeds are, or you can say another way around, the seeds are just about as, the QA and QC seeds are just as hard to find as the UXO, which means they're successful seeds. Being able to find a seed gives us a good prediction to be able to find the UXO. Okay, so now let's go look and see whether the analyst predictions were correct on these things. And, of course, you don't have the patience to listen to, and I certainly don't have the patience to look at all 2,800 of these on this slide, on this talk. But we'll pick a few out. So here's one that's way up at the top, an almost perfect match to the library. So this thing darn sure well better be something that looks like a munition. And so there is the curves we got for it. You can't hardly tell them apart. The colored curves are the thing we measured in the field. The light gray curves behind it are what was named known from the library. And in this case, it matches a 60-millimeter body. When we pull it up, there it is. It's got a funny shadow in it, so you can't quite tell what it is. But it's definitely a 60-millimeter body. So just as predicted by the analyst, this needed to be dug up. Let's do another one. Let's do one next door to it. Coming down a little bit in the match metric. You can see the match is not quite as perfect, which is why the number is 0.98 instead of 0.99 for the decision metric, but pretty much the same. Looks like a small ISO 80. You can tell from the library that we matched it to. And we go dig it up. It's not. And we're maybe not completely surprised about that because the two smaller curves are not exactly on top of each other. So it's a little bit asymmetric, but it's about the size of a small ISO. So we're not a bit sorry that we dug this up. It looked enough like ammunition we needed to dig it up. Okay, here's another one out there, also 0.98. This one matched with a 60-millimeter body. It's not a perfect match, though. See, the curves are just a little bit different. And sure enough, this is a 60-millimeter body with a little hunk out of the side of it. So let me get the pointer back. You can see that little hunk out of the side of it. So there's a little hunk out of it. So you can tell you don't have to be perfect. You don't have to look like you came off the shelf for this to work. We are quite good at detecting anything that is a potential munition. Now, this, of course, you can see from this picture, this is empty. So it's not really a UXO, an unexploded ordnance. It's really the UXO text would label it munitions debris. But you don't know that till you dig it up. So, of course, we have to dig it up. Okay, so now, Ed, we're finishing up. We're getting very close here, and we're getting close to the end of my time. Ed talked to you about the two things we're going to do at the end of the project. We're going to verify the stop dig threshold, and then we're going to validate the whole process. So let's talk about the verification step. Ed told you that our deal is we will dig 200 items past the last TOI. You can see that our contractor was relatively conservative when their choice of threshold, and they've already dug 120 past the last TOI. So per our agreement and our CRAP, they're going to dig 80 more. There they are. Those 80 are also all clutter, so we're good. So we can have some confidence that we drew our stop dig threshold in the right spot. Obviously, as Ed told you, if we had discovered a UXO or some other surrogate or something, some target of interest in that time, we'd have reset the threshold and started this again. But in this case, we are fine, so the threshold is verified. And then the last step is just validate the whole process. So we've seen 2,800 items that came out of the ground here, and we're comfortable that we described them all correctly. Now we have to convince ourselves that the whatever 25,000 minus 2,800 is, 22,000 something targets, that we described them correctly and left them in the ground correctly. So it would be nice to go out and find UXO here. There's little chance of that because there might be two UXO left on this site, and out of 25,000, there's no chance of digging them randomly. So what we're going to do is make sure, here you see the 200 I've randomly chosen to dig, make sure that they're correctly described by the analyst. That'll let us have confidence that the whole procedure is working. So let's do this a couple of times. Oop, sorry. I thought we did that a couple of times. Apologize. So clearly don't do that, but it turns out they all were described by the correctly, and we're done. So at the end of this, the conceptual site model becomes not so conceptual anymore. It becomes a site model, and we can plot it like the following. You can see that the gray bars are how deeply we seeded. We still have the detection depth on there. We have all of the items that we found marked either inert, and that, you know, an example of that was that empty 60-millimeter mortar body I showed you, but also some UXO. There were a lot of 81 millimeters that were UXO. And we have a star by the deepest one. So in all cases, we seeded as deep as any item we found. We can often detect deeper than the items we found, so we have good confidence they're not there. So we can really feel good, and coupling that with the near-surface bedrock, we can really feel confident that we clean this site up. So we have our last team meeting, and everybody's happy. The PM's happy because PM in this case happened to be Ed Walker. He's a very happy guy anyway, but he's happy because we got this done. The DOD PM saved a lot of money. The taxpayers are happy because we saved a lot of money. And the landowner can get us the heck out of the way and start running his cattle again. So he's happy. So now just to finish up, I'll turn this back over to Fred Vreeman, who will do a couple of wrap-up slides for you.
Thanks, Herb. So before we wrap up, here's a couple more questions. Now that you've heard about it, seen the magnitude of the munitions problem, how many sites do you know of where this might be used? So just start answering those. Some states like Alaska and Texas have over 300 sites, while California has over 600. So we don't expect everybody on the call to know about every one of them, but we'd really like to know if this training is getting the word out to enough cleanup teams. And our last question here is, have we convinced you? Would you recommend this at your site? So I don't know. Do you have the polls up there, Juliana?
We do. So we've got quite a few people with one to two sites, and a few with more sites, and of course some that don't have sites. So it looks like we're getting the word out to a wide variety of people. And so far, our big response on would you recommend geophysical classification has been yes, I would consider it. So we have almost 95% in that category.
All right, so that's a successful training then. So now let's wrap things up so you can start using what you learn. At the beginning of the training, I described the problem, 5,200 sites across the country. They're going to take until the next century to clean up. With the new technology, we can pick out just the things that are hazardous and dig them up. A lot of the harmless metal can be left in the ground. So that's what this new technology is going to allow us to do. We took you under the hood, so you've seen how it works. You've learned that this technology is extremely good at finding what we're looking for, but it requires a rigorous approach with quality checks and controls at every step. Properly applied, our target quality standard is 100% of seeds detected. So I think you can feel confident in that. As a regulator, I certainly do. Ed showed you how you need to know your site, and you need to know what you're likely to find there. But anything you can do with a single-axis sensor, you can probably do better with one of these new multi-axis sensors. Ed Carl showed you the brand new Uniform Federal Quality Assurance Project Plan designed for this technology. That's a great template, and it gives you a great tool to help manage your project. And Herb discussed the accreditation program and for the companies who will use the technology. So did Ed, and the strict controls on the source of data used to make these decisions. And then in the case study, we saw how these sensors will be deployed at sites like you might be working on. We gave you links to other resources, and here's those links again. Next slide, 131. And I was asked to replay that slide I showed you earlier. Savings using this more advanced detection technology will amount to billions of dollars. We'll spend a lot more on technology and quality checks, but we'll go over each site and object with a lot more sensors. And we'll prove at each step of the way how we found exactly the items we were looking for and only left the clutter and the fragments in the ground. Slide 132. So there's our website again. And from today's training, you now understand the technology. You understand that to a single-axis sensor, the clutter on the left looks just like the bomb. But a multi-axis sensor can tell you which one looks like a bomb. You learned how to evaluate advanced sensor technology for use on your site. You've learned some GCMR technology and acronyms like GCMR, like TOI and non-TOI. We showed you how you can use multi-axis sensors to make decisions that leave non-hazardous items in the ground. And we've hopefully given you the tools you need to share information within your organization and to stakeholders. The ITRC web-based guidance document's a good way to learn more, and it's a reference for you to go back to when you start managing projects using the technology. You'll find lots of great tips on site evaluations, planning for meetings, and tools for communicating this technology to others. There's links to lots of case studies covering many types of sites, and I'll leave you with this. Think about the sites you'll be working on over the next year. If you're working on a site where single-axis sensors are proposed or being deployed, follow the links to this guidance and at least evaluate whether a multi-axis sensor might be more efficient. If it looks like a fit, then look further in the ITRC guidance for the tools to communicate this technology to decision makers for your project. So now let's answer some of your questions. Back over to you, Juliana.
Thanks, Fred. We are going to have time now to answer questions, so you're welcome to send those in using that Q&A pod. If you're in the phone line, pound 6 to unmute and ask your question out loud. Before we get to those questions, I do want to point out we have links to additional resources, and that pulls together several of the links that we've talked about today. We also have a link to our feedback form, and we do ask that everyone fill out the feedback. We really do use the information that you provide. I also have a poll question here that we'll answer during our second question and answer break. The feedback form is also your opportunity to get a certificate of participation. If you would like a certificate for attending today, please complete the feedback. Press the link at the bottom, and that's going to allow you to get a certificate for attending today. We've had some questions that have come in. Can you describe the limitations of using geophysical classification for detecting munitions that are oriented vertically rather than horizontally?
This is Herb. I'd be happy to answer that. Yeah, in fact, it's maybe that's not the right way to phrase the question. The signal is substantially stronger for vertically oriented munitions than for horizontal oriented munitions, which is why I always gave the examples of the horizontal. They're the hardest. And you can think about that as if you just stand over and look down, there's a whole lot of more metal looking through when you look down at a vertical munition than when it's laying on its side. So that the strongest signal is vertical, the weakest signal is exactly horizontal below you. So that's why we always use horizontal as the examples.
Has a cost-benefit analysis been performed to determine the breakpoint for site size, acres, and the anomaly density, total number of site anomalies, where digging all anomalies is cheaper than using the AGC?
That, you know, that's also a very astute question. And there has been such a thing. John Jackson, who works for the Army Corps CX, has done such a calculation. I don't have it in front of me. He and I have talked about it. I mean, it's pretty clear. We can think about two ends, huh? If you have somebody's backyard and there's six anomalies in there, you don't want to mess with this. You just want to go dig them up and get out of there, huh? I think he told me something like an acre and below, it's easier just to go dig it up. The other thing is a density argument. I think if you were at a huge range on the west and there was five anomalies per acre, it may well be cheaper to just go dig them up than to do all of the surveying and everything, because there are a lot of time lost going from one anomaly to another. So I would suggest that maybe we will take this question, and I assume your name's associated with it, and we can put you in touch with John Jackson, who's done has an Excel spreadsheet where he's worked all of that out.
Thanks. I've noted that. Do you have any examples or a place to go for information about safety equipment, procedures required when digging up suspected UXOs?
Yeah, but I'm not the one. The Department of Defense Explosive Safety Board regulates all of those aspects of it. The people that you've been talking to today, we really stop when we hand that list over to the trained UXO technicians who do this, who work under Explosive Safety Board guidance. They file something called an Explosive Safety Submission, which lays out the distances they'll be away from people and other things based on the size of the munition. There's a hazardous radius that you have to stay outside of. So I'm really not the right person to ask about that. I would think maybe contacting the person you're working with at the Corps who could point you toward those things.
Is it the horizontal location of seeds obvious to technicians due to visible disturbance in the ground surface? What does this mean for the reliability of the methods being used?
Yeah, well, that's certainly right, huh? They ought to be able to see. I mean, when you plant seeds, if it's a site that has a good grass cover, you try to take the plug out, put it back in, step on it, make it not so obvious. But there are certainly sites where the disturbed earth is a dead clue. But as my colleague Jordan Addison always says, you don't just turn in a list; you have to show your work. So the QC geophysicist better see the signal right where you're reporting it to be. The QA core person that's overlooking this better see the signal right where you're reporting it to be. If all you did was stick a flag in the ground and the sensor didn't see it, then you'll be caught pretty quickly.
Yeah, and Herb, this is Ed. To add on to that, you know, the organizations that seek accreditation, they actually have to go to the we have a site at Aberdeen that basically is a big field of inert plus inert munition items plus frag. And these have been sort of weathered in time, and you can't see. They cannot tell whatsoever where these items are, and that's part of the accreditation program as well. So so they are checked, and there's no way they can tell where those items are at Aberdeen.
A participant sent in a comment that said that they were told that it's $40,000 to $50,000 per acre, which they found very cost prohibitive. Any comments from trainers?
Well, I mean, you can see our site. This, we can go back to slide, whatever it was. We were some number like that, weren't we? We cost $3.5 million for 100 acres. So that's, is that $35,000 per acre? That's what it cost to clean up UXO sites. It would have been $60,000 per acre if we had dug them all. In round numbers, I think it's fair to say it costs $125 to dig up every target you dig up on a UXO site. So it is a crazy number. Oh, there they are. Good job, whoever is running the slides. But that's the total project cost. Look it up. Look through that table. There's a lot of things to do with MOB and DMOB, planning meetings, project websites, safety submissions. That's the cost of doing business, I'm afraid. I would love to drop that by an order of magnitude, but I don't know how.
If costing for a feasibility study, where are the best places to get anticipated detection depths and costs?
So, I would say this. So let me answer more fully for those that may not know where that question's going. Clearly, the best thing to do would have been to use some of these advanced sensors through the RI, and then you would have an idea of what the density are to these sensors, what the costs were for these sensors. Then you could really fairly cost this alternative in the FS. Okay. I assume, by the way you asked that question, it means you're stuck. It was a more traditional RI, and you're looking to have one of the alternatives be using advanced geophysical classification, one being used traditional digging, one may be a fence, one may be doing nothing. Huh? So I would think that you would go to the ESTCP demos. They were done in a variety of sites. Try to find one that looks like yours, whether it's a pasture land in the upper Midwest, or it's a mountainous region in California, and you can extrapolate costs from that, I think, to your site. That might have to do a little dancing based on this, the expected anomaly density, but at least you can get some part of the way there doing that.
A couple of people asked a similar question. I know Ed Coral answered online, but I'm going to go ahead and read it in case other people on the call have similar questions. Is there a method in place to obtain a waiver or exception to the 200 additional items in the QC check if you're working at a small site with a small number of detections? If a small site only has 1,000 hits, an additional 400 beyond the selected could be considered cost prohibitive.
So, Ed, you answered. You wanted me to answer, and see if I answer the same as you.
In short, I mean, obviously, there's going to be situations where that, and it's 200 actually, where that 200 may not make sense for a site, right? It might, if you have 100 non-TOIs, maybe 200 is a little bit of an overkill for that site. So there are going to be exceptions, but we have found in the vast majority of investigations that 200 number for most investigations we found historically really will work, but it really is a project team decision. So that's something that the project team would decide, and you would just document that in the QAP. So it's sort of a negotiable number, and as long as the project team, especially our regulatory partners, agree on it, then that's the number you would use.
Thank you. We are out of questions, so we'll go ahead and wrap up a little bit early today. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us. If you have questions that we haven't addressed, or if you're trying to type in a question now, please send that to training@itrcweb.org, and we'll coordinate following up with trainers to get your question answered. Again, a reminder to fill out that feedback form. We really do use your feedback and appreciate you taking just a few minutes now to complete the feedback